Hey everyone, this is Ashley Menzies Babatunde, your host and resident storyteller, and welcome to another episode of No Straight Path, the highs, the lows, and the lessons learned. No Straight Path is brought to you by the HubSpot Podcast Network, the audio destination for business professionals. We are digging into the human stories behind success, and my hope, as always, is that you leave the conversation inspired, motivated, and excited about your journey. Hey friends, hey, I hope you are well. We have another insightful episode for this week. I had a great conversation with Phil Agnew, and he is the host of the UK's number one marketing podcast, Nudge. And we're actually in the HubSpot Podcast Network together. Grateful to be in his company. And on the show, he interviews experts in psychology and behavioral science to try to better understand how humans make decisions. Yes, you know, I love people and understanding people. So I was so excited about this conversation. And he has spent over a decade in senior marketing roles at Buffer, Hotjar, and Brandwatch, where he has helped launch products in social media, website analytics, and AI. And I just learned so much from this conversation with Phil. We cover the things I love, of course, so childhood, setbacks, pivots, but we do it from Phil's perspective, which is rooted in behavioral psychology. And it felt like a vulnerable conversation mixed with a college course in behavioral psychology. Yes, I know it sounds like an odd mix, but I promise it works. It really worked. And I think you're going to love this conversation. So let's get to it. All right, Phil, I am so excited to have you on the podcast. I just can't wait to dig into your story. You have just such an interesting journey, and I feel like I love listening to your podcast, but I have so many different questions about you. So I'm excited to learn more. Thank you, thank you, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. And yeah, I'm really excited to chat today. I love your show. You know, it asks entrepreneurs different questions than what they would typically be asked in the normal interview. And I definitely think some of the things you'll ask me today are things that I probably haven't been asked before. So I'm very excited.
Good, good. So Phil, let's start from the beginning. Tell us about your childhood. Tell us about how you grew up.
My parents were very career orientated when I was younger. And I think that's probably shaped a lot of my life today. But we had a lovely childhood. I've got two sisters, and there was a lot of enjoyment and laughter and fun in the house when we were younger. Yeah, we were definitely taught the value of work when we were young. Both my parents worked 9-to-5 jobs. My mum especially is a real role model for me in terms of her career. And that career focus, I think, definitely has influenced all of our siblings growing up. I wasn't very academic when I was younger at all. One thing that I noticed is that I really hated reading when I was younger, which is kind of funny now because it's something I really enjoy. And it's the backbone of my podcast really is reading an awful lot of books about behavioral science and talking to authors about them. But it wasn't something I was into at all when I was younger. My main sort of passion when I was younger was drama and theatre. I really loved performing and being on stage. That was, I think, the thing I was most excited about. I always dreamt of being an actor, that sort of cliche thing, but I really enjoyed that part of my life. And yeah, I spent a lot of time thinking about doing that. And I think that's definitely partly shaped who I am today. And then another big aspect of my childhood in terms of thinking about my education was I was diagnosed with dyslexia when I was quite young. And that, I think that was a really interesting thing when I reflect back on my life in terms of how it shaped my education. I think that diagnosis definitely helped me in many ways, but also hindered me in others in terms of giving me a label and making me think maybe that I wasn't able to read as many books as I would like or wasn't as academic as I'd hoped to be. So that definitely affected me. And I remember maybe not giving my all to my academic performance when I was younger too. But yeah, a really lovely childhood. And I think in a way it's shaped who I am today, but in interesting ways. I wasn't much of a reader when I was younger. I am now. I wanted to be an actor when I was younger, and I'm a podcaster now, which is quite different. But I think in a lot of ways, there's paths there which have helped me become who I am today.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for sharing that. And, you know, you said there was a switch. So you are a big reader now, and I am surprised to hear that you weren't a big reader growing up. You know, when did that change happen?
Yeah, so I really think this was something to do with there's a lot in psychology about the labels you give people and how that changes their behavior. This is known as the confirmation bias. When we have an opinion or a view, we will seek data, information, views that match that opinion. So for example, if you are a big fan of a certain sports team, you'll seek out lots of articles that match your views. So saying that sports team is wonderful or that your rival team is awful, you'll love that views. Whereas views which say that your sports team actually is a bit below par, you won't bother reading. And I think as a child, being diagnosed with dyslexia, it sort of had the same effect on me, where I was being told that I would struggle with reading, that I would struggle with writing and struggle with spelling. And I sort of looked for things in my life that proved that point. So I didn't read many books. And I think that was maybe in part me proving the fact that I was dyslexic in a way. Or I didn't make much of an effort with learning how to spell properly when I was younger. I think that was maybe part of it as well. There's this, some really interesting studies about the sort of nouns that you use to define children, especially. So there's this great study with Christopher Byron, who asked children in this nursery to help clean up. And the way he asked them changed how likely they were to clean up. So when he asked them, can you help clean up? Very few did. But when he asked them, can you be a helper? Many more did. Same with voting. When people are asked, can you be a voter? More and more likely to vote than when you say, can you vote? So it's sort of this self-identity thing, how you view yourself. If you view yourself as a helper or a voter, you're more likely to do those actions. If you view yourself as academic, you're probably more likely to read. And yeah, so a lot of my childhood, I just didn't view myself as that person. And I think maybe that's partly due to dyslexia label or something else, but I didn't view myself as that person. And it probably wasn't until I was in my first job and performing fairly well, I remember probably, you know, early 20s, realizing, oh, if I'm now almost seeking more views to match my belief, I'm doing well in my job, surely I must be able to read lots of books and really get into that side of it. And then that's when I started to read and actually discovered a world of behavioral science through those books and stuff like that. But it was probably only once I had seen in my life behaviors which could change my view of myself. There's this theory in behavioral science that attitudes don't lead to behaviors. It's that behaviors lead to attitudes. If you do something a lot, you will gain an attitude which matches that behavior. And I think that's visible in a lot of my sort of upbringing and early career.
Wow, I love that. And listeners, this is just a taste of what Phil does on his podcast. So it's just so fascinating how you've used behavioral science to just describe your childhood and your upbringing, your relationship with reading. So I love that, how it's just really become a part of you. And you also mentioned that you loved acting. And I think that's incredible. And I do think it's a little bit reflective of being a podcaster. There's an art to this. There's a bit of performance to this. Even the way that you put your podcast together, I would say there's a lot of story and there's science and it's smart. And you can see that in the entertainment industry. It's a form of entertainment. So do you feel like you're living out a little bit of your actor dreams in your podcasting?
Potentially. I think anybody who has studied, you know, theatre studies or drama or acting when they were younger, or perhaps maybe up until 18 or maybe even beyond, that process it's so different from any other part of academia. The muscle you're trying to grow is not knowledge, is not physicality. It's you're trying to get really good at authentically appearing to be different people, which is a really odd thing to do for part of a profession. But in doing that, I think you gain an awful lot. Because as an individual, you gain the ability, there's this, you know, well-known idea that we all contain multiple different versions of ourselves. So the way I'm acting with you, Ashley, is different from how I would act with my partner. It's different from how I would act with my best friend. It's different from how I'd act with my work colleague. It's different from how I'd act with my parents. So we're constantly changing our mannerisms and our tone of speaking, the way we even express ourselves, depending on who we're with. There's a lot of evidence in the world of sales that your ability to mirror the person you're talking to sort of mirror their body language, their actual language as well, will dramatically increase the chances that you'll be able to sell to them or get a higher tip if you're a waiter or waitress, all these things. And so acting is really giving you an incredible course in how to authentically be a different person, authentically be a different version of yourself. For a salesperson, that could be to really well mirror the person you're talking to and sell better to them. For a podcaster, that could be a bit like you're doing right now, Ashley, to act in a way which makes me feel really comfortable and more likely to share genuine stories about myself. Or, you know, for other creators, that could mean many different things. But I think it's, even though it's a very novel and different form of academia, acting, or education, I should say, it was incredibly mm-hmm. useful because it gives you a lot of skills that you would just not get from any other form of education, which I think have been incredibly useful today as a podcaster.
Yeah, yeah. And I am just curious because we've been talking a lot about authenticity on the podcast lately, and you were talking about different versions of yourself. Do you think you can be authentically yourself with different versions of yourself? Does that make sense? Because sometimes there's this challenge in society when you are bending and twisting to sell to someone, or you are changing yourself in various different environments, that you may lose your authentic self or lose who you are. And I think that's something that the millennial generation we've been talking about. Is there any science about this?
Yeah, there's definitely, well, first of all, I would guess that the perception we have that we should be a very particular person and that is our authentic self, and we should always stick with the attitudes and behavior that that one person has, is probably quite new and probably isn't something that is commonplace in the past. Because of social media, mm-hmm. we now have, you know, these profiles which are supposed to show our authentic self. They never do, as we all know. They show a very rose-tinted version of ourselves, but they are supposed to show, you know, we don't have an Instagram for Phil when he's in a good mood, an Instagram for Phil when he's in a bad mood, an Instagram for Phil when he's being professional, an Instagram for Phil when he's being dorky. We just have an Instagram for Phil. Of course, there are different profiles and, you know, maybe you can show your authentic self in different ways, but anyway, my point is, mm-hmm. I think a social network is pushing this idea that there is one authentic self that all of us have. And to show our authentic self, we should act in the same way all of the time, no matter who we're speaking to. But I think that is quite novel and new. I think if you looked back in the past, mm-hmm. you would see it's really common for people to act in a slightly different way when they're at work to when they're at home. It's really common for people to act in a slightly different way when they're with friends, when they're with colleagues. And that was quite a normal thing. Now, whether or not that's good or bad is probably a debate which is longer than this podcast, but it's, I would say, pretty normal mm-hmm. for people to be able to change their behavior based on who they're with. And if we look at what the psychology says, it's a really good thing to help us collaborate and get along. So I shared earlier this research into mirroring for salespeople. This is really, really foolproof research which showcases that if you mirror the actions of other people, you will increase your likability, you'll increase your ability to collaborate, all of these wonderful things. It's not just the case with salespeople, it's the case with teamwork and all these other areas. But if, on the other hand, you were purposely acting in a different way to the people, because that was, you viewed that as your authentic self, if you didn't make the effort to change your behaviors to match them, you would probably end up not collaborating with them in the same way. It's a bit like if you imagine going abroad, for example, or you go and meet people who are from a completely different culture, you should be encouraged to change your behavior and your actions and maybe even hold back some of your views to better fit in with that group, to better fit in with that culture, because it will allow you to collaborate better. And I think that's maybe what I would say is being authentic is not about being very firm on one point of view or only showcasing one side of your personality or not molding to the people you're meeting. I think it's more basic than that, because all of those things are really important if you want to increase collaboration.
Yeah, no, I think those are great points. And I've been thinking about that too. And I think as humans, we're dynamic. And so I always say I'm a people person. I love people. And you do act a bit differently based on different environments, and that's okay. I think we can have different authentic versions of ourselves, right? We can have authentic versions of ourselves at work. So there's certain cultural norms that you're going to still adhere to, but perhaps you want to push certain initiatives and you want to maybe stand your ground on specific things that you want to see in the culture. Maybe that's your authentic self. It's trying to stay true to the things you want to see in the workplace, but there's still these cultural norms and ways that you want to relate to people that's important to understand. And so, I don't know, I'm going to do some more research on that, but I really love your take.
There's something else as well, Ashley, which is just when you were talking, mm-hmm. I was thinking about what does authentic self even mean? I mean, you could take the way you dress as an example, like the way I would dress differently depending yeah. on who I'm with. And your authenticity can directly correlate with your experience or your expertise or your stature within an organization. So there's this really incredible study into this principle known as the red sneakers effect, which is this idea, or it was this study which was conducted with researchers who are at these big academic conferences. And for this study, people would note exactly what people were wearing when they would come into this academic conference. So were they conforming to the dress code? So wearing a suit, tie, smart clothes, smart shoes, or were they non-conforming? Were they coming in a t-shirt and red sneakers and jeans, for example? And most people would conform, but some people would come in and they wouldn't conform. They would wear the red sneakers. And then what the people behind this study did is they went and spoke to the people who wore suits and the people who, and basically every participant in this conference. And they would ask them, because they were researchers, how many citations do you have? So a citation is when you are referenced by another researcher for the work that you've done. The more citations you have, the more higher up in your field you are, the more expertise you have. And they found something really fascinating, that people who had more citations were far more likely to dress differently. They were more likely to break conventions and wear those red sneakers, for example. And so there's an argument there which suggests that they are being more authentic. They're being more true to themselves. They would just wear jeans and red sneakers at home. So that's what they're wearing at the conference. But it's actually showcasing that authenticity only comes out of them being confident and knowing that they are the experts within their field, knowing that they are better than the majority of their peers. That allows them to be authentic. Mark Zuckerberg can get away with wearing Adidas sliders in the office into investor meetings because he's the CEO, founder, and one of the richest men in the world. The junior intern at Facebook or Meta isn't going to be able to do the same thing and get away with it because that person does not have that level of expertise. So authenticity is difficult because it can actually depend on how you're viewed by others. And you might struggle to be your authentic self if you don't have the same stature as say, the CEO, for example, who is possibly able to be more of their authentic self than you.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's so true. They say once you get to a certain level, then you can do what you want. Or just what they always say, even with older folks, they say everything that's on their mind because they're in their 80s and they have all the wisdom and knowledge. And so they can be their true authentic selves. It'll be interesting to see how the culture changes here in the research. And so we may have to have you come back on for a part two at some point to chat more. But I do want to get to Nudge. I want to get to your podcast, the number one marketing podcast in the UK. It's such a good podcast. It's so smart. It has great storytelling. And I'm curious, you know, how did you get here? What inspired you to start the podcast? Tell us a little bit about that journey.
Yeah. So the typical story I give, which maybe some of the listeners who have heard me before talk about this, is that I went to university. I studied marketing at university, which is actually quite rare in the UK. Most people wouldn't study marketing, but I was convinced it was a good idea. I'm not convinced now that it was. It was very expensive. It cost me £50,000. It's an awful lot of money. And I think it was a bit of a waste of time because I went into my first job and I was doing a marketing job and I basically found that I was pretty much useless at the majority of tasks I was given. I was asked to write a blog that people would click on and I couldn't do it. And I was asked to write an email that people would open and I wasn't any better than anybody else. I'd studied all these tenets of marketing strategy and I realized I knew nothing about human behavior. I wasn't able to change the decisions that people made. I wasn't able to convince people to buy the thing I was selling over anything else. And so I really struggled in my first few years in marketing. And then probably around the point we spoke about earlier, when I started reading books, I discovered behavioral science. And this is just a field of research into the behavior people make and why people make the decisions they do. It's basically the field of psychology. And it was fascinating to me because it basically revealed that the tasks I was being asked to do, they're not tasks that you execute on just based on gut instinct. You can leverage a lot of these laws and these biases from the world of behavioral science to actually write a better email copy or create a blog that gets people to click. And so I started to read all these wonderful books about behavioral science and I just started to apply it to my work. So I would be writing an email and I would apply one of these principles. I'd be writing a blog or I'd apply another principle. And that's sort of just where it ended with me. I didn't really think about it at all until then at any point in terms of creating a podcast or anything like that. But then I took, and this actually might be relevant to you, it might be something you've experienced as well, I took a sabbatical from my job in 2019. We took, I think, 6 or 8 months to go away, and we traveled around New Zealand. We lived in New Zealand for a while and then traveled around South America as well. And I basically, I think this is definitely a takeaway that I've had in my life, having time away from a full-time job, having time to focus on nothing but just, I don't know, living for those 6 months really gave me a bit of space to think about what I want to be doing with my life and what I want to create and all of these things. And it was during that sabbatical when I realized, oh, I'd actually really love to do a podcast on this subject. I'd really love to interview people about it. And so I decided to email a few of the authors that I really liked, a few of the researchers whose research I admired. And fortunately, they agreed to to come on my show and let me interview them. And it went from there. And that's how I started the podcast. But the takeaway I have looking back on it is, I think there was lots of inspiration to start a podcast, inspiration that all of us see all the time. We always see people on LinkedIn talking about how wonderful their stuff is. Or we always see people writing books, telling people to take risks. But the inspiration was always there. I think what's more interesting for me is that the sabbatical really gave me the time and the space to think about it and to actually make the commitment to start it. And my takeaway, I'm not the first to say this, but my takeaway from that is that it's really important in your life to give yourself space and give yourself time to do something which isn't just your 9-to-5 job. Because in doing that, you'll probably end up discovering things you want to work on, projects you want to start. And that was definitely the case for me.
Yeah, so I definitely love that. I definitely agree that just taking time to reflect, taking time for yourself, it always leads to creativity. And I think that's really important. And it's something that we lose, especially as we get older, as we're adults and we're working in our jobs. We don't focus on creativity because it can be challenging. It's competing with a lot of other things in our life. So the fact that you're able to take that time and then create something so wonderful that helps so many people, I think is great. And I think it's just another testament to why we need more sabbaticals. So leaders, if you're listening to the podcast right now, you might want to add a sabbatical program to your company. And I'm curious about how you built out your brand. Tell me about some of the challenges that you faced.
Yeah, I think what's been particularly difficult for me as a creator who's been working a full-time job whilst creating is managing side projects with full-time work. So in the 4 years that I've run Nudge since 2019, I've had 3 different jobs. And I've actually found myself picking jobs that will better accommodate my side project, basically. So the moves I've made, I've always accommodated that. Being the most recent move was to a company called Buffer, who really, really invest in side projects and make sure that you're set up in a way where you can work on them. In fact, they even have a 4-day work week where they encourage you to work on your own thing on the 4th day. So that's been really helpful. But I have noticed that to grow my brand, I've even changed my career. And that, you know, one of the most recent things I've done, which I think hopefully will help me overcome this challenge of not being able to invest as much time as I want or not being able to invest as much energy, is I've decided to leave my full-time job for the first time and go full-time on the podcast. So last week I told my company I was leaving and I'm going full-time. And that was a challenging decision to make, not an easy decision to make. But one of the things I was actually inspired by was there's a really good by Dan Pink, who wrote the book Power of Regrets. Brilliant author. And this book, Power of Regrets, is fascinating because he asks, I think it's something incredible, like 50,000 people to share their regrets. And so 50,000 people emailed Dan with all these different types of regrets they had. Regrets about not reaching out to that girl that they met on the train who they fell in love with, or regrets about not starting that business with that partner that they think would have taken off, or regrets about maybe not ordering that thing at that restaurant that they went to when they were in Canada and they really wish they could go back and try it now. All these regrets. And he analyzed them in all these different ways. So discovered what are the most typical regrets people have, or what are the categories that are most typical. But one of the findings, one of the main takeaways he had was the structure of the regret. So how likely were people to regret actions that they had taken versus actions that they hadn't taken? So were people more likely to regret taking an action, so starting that business or asking that girl on a date or eating that food or not doing the thing? And he found conclusively across every gender, all demographics, all age ranges, that the regrets that people had were for not taking action rather than taking action. So people were far more likely to regret not starting that business, not asking that person out, whatever it might be. And I think that has stuck with me with a lot of my life decisions, where I found myself wondering, should I make this call? Should I start this business? Should I go full time on my podcast? And I think back to that study, and I think back to the regrets people have. And I've sort of told myself that, well, I will regret it more if I don't try it. So even if it might fail, even if it might not work, I'll regret not doing something rather than sticking with the status quo, which is the easier thing to do. So yeah, those are some of the challenges I've faced. And I think what's really helped me overcome them is this idea that you will regret inaction more than action.
Yeah, so I love that you brought that up. I actually haven't read that book yet by Dan Pink, but I've seen it and heard about it and listened to him on podcasts. And I think it is really fascinating, The Power of Regret. And so it's still on my list. And, you know, I'm curious about some of the psychology principles that you think could be helpful for people as they navigate their career. You've mentioned so many thus far as you've been talking and just the way that you shared your story. But if you have any principles for listeners that you think could be helpful, I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, well, we spoke about authentic self earlier, and there's one that I do think about which links to that, which is a principle known as the Pratfall effect. And it's a really interesting principle. It was a study conducted back in the 60s with a researcher called Elliot Aronson. And for this study, he filmed an actor answering a series of quiz questions very proficiently. So getting 90% of the questions right, this actor really looked like a genius. And then at the end of the quiz questions, the actor took a sip of his coffee and actually managed to spill the coffee all down his white shirt. So made a bit of a fool of himself. And the researcher, Elliot Aronson, he showed this recording of the actor answering questions right to participants. The participants were told this is just a quiz contestant. They weren't told it was an actor. But he added a bit of a twist. So half the participants in Elliot's study saw the full uncut version of this recording. So they saw the actor answer all the questions correctly and then spill coffee down himself. And the other half saw an edited version. So they saw the actor answer all the questions but not spill the coffee down himself. So slight tweak. One just sees a bit of a flaw, a bit of a weakness, clumsiness in the quiz answerer. And Elliot Aronson then interviewed each of the participants and asked them about how intelligent they thought the quiz contestant was, but also how likable they thought he was. And what he found, which was really interesting, is that the likability changed dramatically based on whether or not this person spilt coffee down themselves. So when the person spilt coffee down themselves, he was ranked as extremely likable, very likable. But when they didn't, he was actually ranked as quite unlikable. So that small thing of just spilling coffee down himself changed his likability. And this revealed this sort of world of psychology, which suggests that imperfect things that have good elements are actually more likable than fully perfect things. So a similar version of this study was conducted much more recently by Jo Sylvester in Cardiff University in Wales. And in her study, she got a bunch of her research assistants to apply for a number of different jobs, so to send out CVs for all sorts of different jobs and then go in for interviews. She made sure that each time the research assistant applied, they usually showed the same set of skills, the same experience, so it was as much consistency as possible. But then she encouraged the research assistants in half of the interviews to only show their strengths, to only show that the reasons why they should be hired. And then in the other half of the interviews they did, to also show their weaknesses. So to tell people about their strengths, but also say, by the way, I'm not very good in this area. Now, rationally, we would expect the research assistants who only show their strengths to be more likely to get a job. After all, people are hiring people for their strengths, not for their weaknesses. But right. In reality, what happens is the people who showcased their weaknesses, the people who flaunted their flaws, were far more likely to get the job. They were far more likely to get into the second round. They're far more likely to have their CV accepted, whatever it might have been. And so the finding here of this Pratfall effect, discovered way back with that coffee spilling experiment to people applying for jobs today, is that by embracing your weaknesses, by showcasing your weaknesses, by not trying to hide them, will make you more likable, will make you more likely to get a job, will do all these wonderful things for you, which I think is really important to recognize, you know, when you're trying to be your authentic self. Because there's this idea that we want to hide the negative things about our lives on LinkedIn. We only want to showcase our success stories. But actually, this research would suggest that the opposite is true. By showcasing some of the weaknesses you have, by showcasing some of your flaws, you're probably more likely to increase your likability and to get the things that you want to achieve.
So thank you so much for sharing that, because it's actually so validating and I feel so affirmed in the work that I'm doing, because I think it's so important to share our humanity. And it was interesting, I had a guest on not too long ago, Hannah Pryor. She's a workplace expert and a keynote speaker, and she talks all about embracing our awkwardness in our careers and how that is extremely helpful and how it helps us be more relatable. And not that we should showcase it, you know, to the world, but just to embrace it and that it's okay. And I think that the fact that the research is really supporting our humanity, supporting who we are as dynamic human beings, and that it's helpful for us, feels really, really good. So thank you for sharing that. And you've just shared so many gems. I think that, you know, your journey has been so interesting. I'm so excited for you now that you're going into this full-time entrepreneurship. You have built out this really big brand with amazing content. And I'm curious if you've thought about this, you know, about your life purpose or your career purpose. Can you talk to us a little bit about purpose?
Yeah, it's a difficult thing to answer for a British person, I think. We just don't really talk about purpose. We just sort of just get on with it. But it's a great question. It is something I think about a lot, especially career purpose. And probably the thing that I think about most, I'm going to reference Dan Pink again. Clearly, he's had a big impact on my life. He wrote a book called Drive, which is one of the first books I read, you know, when I first mentioned that I started reading. And he spoke in that book about how people are motivated and how they're encouraged to work and do the things they do. He said some controversial things in that book as well, you know, specifically about maybe not incentivizing salespeople and stuff like that, which was interesting. But his main takeaway on motivation was that to motivate people, you have to give them autonomy. So you have to give them freedom to work on the things they want to work, the ability to potentially even work when they want to work, the freedom to share their own point of view, all that things. So you have to give them autonomy. You have to give them the ability to get mastery. He calls it mastery. And what does he mean by mastery? Well, he means this ability to master a certain subject. So mastery being, I want to get fantastic at podcasting. So I want to learn all there is about interviewing. I want to learn all there is about behavioral science. And I think it's really that feeling of every day you work on it, you can see yourself getting better. In a way that an artist who paints for every single day of her life will see herself getting much better as she ages and progresses. And so mastery, I think, is really important as well. You've got autonomy, you've got mastery. And then the final thing he talks about is purpose. And he defines it quite loosely. So purpose could be you're working on something which has purpose in the world, perhaps working for an NGO or a charity which is really making an impact, or you're working on something which has purpose for you. Maybe you're working with a local community that's close to your heart, or you're working on a project which is bringing people things that you value. And purpose, I think, is really important as well. You want to be able to wake up each morning and think, the thing I'm doing today has purpose. If I wasn't doing this thing, there would be people who would suffer, or people who wouldn't be happy, for example, probably more so if you're a podcaster. People aren't going to suffer if you stop recording, but people might not be happy. And so those are the three things I think about a lot in my career. I want to have autonomy, I want to be able to master a subject, and I want the thing I'm doing to have purpose. And that's defined a lot of my life choices. So I think one of the reasons podcasting is so attractive to me is because running your own business gives you a lot of autonomy, gives the ability to pick your own hours, to decide who you want to interview, what episodes you want to create, how you want to create those episodes, a huge amount of autonomy. There's that real feeling of mastery. Every single month I work on this podcast, the better I will get, the higher quality my shows will be, the more listeners hopefully they'll attract, but more so just I can listen back and really hear progression, which I value. And then purpose as well. And I think purpose for me is probably a more difficult one, because you know, what purpose is there in running a marketing podcast, you could say, and you could argue, but maybe you just view it as there is purpose in creating something in the world that other people value. And that's probably more purposeful. It's got more purpose to it than simply being, at least in my opinion, one part of a giant organization where your work is not as visible, for example. So Yeah, in my career, I think a lot about autonomy, mastery, and purpose. And then in life, I've got no idea, actually. I'm too British. I've got no good wisdom for you there.
You know what? You did great. I forgot about just the British culture. And it's so interesting because my grandmother, she was from Guyana, but her father was British. And it took her like 15 years to say, "I love you" to me. I would say, "I love you." And she'd say, "Ditto, kiddo." And as she got older, she just became so much more American. And so, and not that the Brits aren't sweet. She loved me so much, but so much more affectionate. And I was like, finally, we got you. And so the fact that you have even contemplated and thought about your career purpose, I think is beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. You've shared so many gems. If you have any final thoughts to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, I think the one thing that I haven't talked about much before on any other podcast or anything else is this dyslexia label. And I think when I reflect back on my life, it really did have an impact on me. It really did change my perception of myself and what I could achieve and what I should be doing and what I should be reading or not read and where I should be focusing my time. And it really did impact me. If I reflect back on it, that label, I think, changed a bit of my trajectory. And so one thing I would say to people who have dyslexia or perhaps have children with dyslexia is to, I think, acknowledge that, you know, that this is a real thing and that, you know, this is something people should be aware of. And it's really important to accommodate that and to set up environments in which you'll be able to better function. Those things are all really important. But one thing that I would also say, at least I know this helped me, I don't know if this will help anyone else, but don't let that label define you. Don't change your behavior because you have been defined as being dyslexic or whatever it might be. Because I definitely did. I definitely didn't bother trying to read because I just thought I couldn't. I definitely didn't bother trying to creatively write, which is something I really enjoy now because I didn't think I could. I spent much more of my time doing subjects and works on things which were different from basically what I was told I couldn't do. And so that's just something that stuck with me a lot recently, and I sort of wished that I'd known more about when I was younger. And it's probably advice which isn't too helpful for some people, and probably advice that most people just get intuitively. But for me, that's advice that I would have wanted to hear. So don't let those labels define you, is probably my final thought.
I love it. No, I think it's extremely helpful, and it's a good reminder for so many people. Thank you so much, Phil.
Thanks, Ashley. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to another episode of No Straight Path, the highs, the lows, and the lessons learned. Remember to share the podcast with friends and family. And my hope is that these stories help you navigate your No Straight Path journey. If this content is adding value to your life, and I hope it is, please take a few minutes out of your day to rate the show and write a review. You can click the link in the show notes to write a review. It helps other listeners find the show, and I just really appreciate it. Have a lovely week, embrace the journey, and remember, you're not alone.